list. You can find all the local chapters listed there. You can see the campaigns we're doing, but definitely get on our list.
And this apartheid Israeli apartheid week is coming up. When is that going to be?
It's in later March or now. I think it's in March, and it happens at slightly different times all over the world, actually. But there will be events at campuses everywhere.
That's something we didn't get a chance to talk about, the apartheid in Israel, more than just a metaphor, but maybe for another show. Thank you so much, Cecily Saraski.
You bet. Thank you so much.
All right. And this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
3 Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast, rich man's war, the poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real, rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking
earth. As citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KBOO is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. Right away, it's Political Perspectives. Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Sharman Apt Russell about citizen science and her book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. Call in with your questions about citizen science at 503-231-8187. At 10 on Air Cascadia, host Chris Andre presents part two of her interview with CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein talks with student debt strikers and organizers, also with anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman, about new revelations about earthquake dangers and the future of California's Diablo Canyon nukes. And at 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with futurist, educator, and author Barbara Max Hubbard about conscious evolution, awakening the power of our social potential. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking right where it says Donate Today. Thanks for doing that. And now we're going to get right to Kathleen Stevenson and her guest, Sharman Apt Russell. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Tammy. Thank you. I am speaking with award-winning nature writer Sharman Apt Russell, whose new book is Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World, published by Oregon State University Press. Sharman Apt Russell lives in southwestern New Mexico and teaches writing at Western New Mexico University and Antioch University in New Mexico. Her books include Standing in the Light, An Obsession with Butterflies, and Anatomy of a Rose. Her awards include a Rockefeller Fellowship and a Pushcart Prize. Sharman Apt Russell, we spoke 6 months ago or so about this, but we weren't able to connect in person, and now you're here in the studio visiting Portland. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Oh, thank you. It's really great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about citizen science, just to explain to people what that concept means.
Well, it's really a revolution in the sense of how technology and the internet has allowed citizen science to expand. It's not new. Charles Darwin had a network of amateurs which sent in observations about the natural world by the penny post. So these were just working class men and middle class women and shopkeepers. And We replaced the PIN with the login. And now tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people can work with scientists on projects, helping to classify information, helping to gather information, sometimes staying online completely, sometimes going out in the natural world and using better and better field guides and smarter phone apps to really collaborate with scientists in their research. They're non-scientist. They're not professionally trained, but they're able to partner with scientists to do real science.
And let's talk a little bit about your own background, because you don't consider yourself a real scientist.
Oh, I'm not. My undergraduate is in conservation and natural resources, which was very much an interdisciplinary degree. And then, of course, I got a MFA in writing, because I'm a writer. Now, I am a science writer. I'm a nature writer. I have a deep engagement with the natural world, and I've written, my books often have to do with that connection to the landscape or that connection to nature. But I started doing citizen science just because it's so pleasurable, really. I was working with a group where I live in southwestern New Mexico to band birds. And, you know, to be able to hold a bird in your hand, untangling it from the net, and just feel that kind of life beating there. And then to band it and let it go, of course, and to be part of a larger study, in that case about avian flu. You know, it was just deeply satisfying.
Right. And so when exactly was that you sort of went from being a nature writer to a citizen scientist?
To a citizen scientist. Well, I was banding birds for the book Standing in the Light, and that was an exploration about my spiritual beliefs and my connection to land. And so it was kind of natural to have a season of banding birds as part of that. And then I went on to do other citizen science programs. I've always been privileged to live in an area very rich with archaeological sites. So I'm what they call site steward, in which three or four times a year we go out and monitor an archaeological site and check it for damage, for looting, for natural damage, as well as human damage. So I live right by the Gila National Forest. So there's all kinds of entrances I can have into my neighborhood, my backyard, through citizen science. And then, of course, I decided I really wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about the bigger picture of citizen science.
Mm-hmm. And so the book Diary of a Citizen Scientist has somewhat the feel of a diary, but also the feel of a book of essays in a way, because certain topics will kind of take your fancy for
right,
a while.
Right. That's deliberate. It's a writerly strategy. You know, I did want the present tense, and it was two field seasons of chasing tiger beetles and of pursuing a particular biological question about the larval biology of the western red-bellied tiger beetle. And I wanted that sense of the naturalist notebook. And so the book is this kind of alchemy of the notes I took, the memories, the things that actually happened that day, to kind of imitate the feel of a diary and the feel of a journal. And it certainly had that journey for me. When I started the book, I didn't have a publisher. I didn't have that kind of structure, which I've had in the past. And I didn't know what I would learn. I was given the task by two mentors, two entomologists, of discovering the larval biology of this particular beetle. But I didn't know if I was going to do that, if that would be accomplished. It was definitely going into the unknown.
Mm-hmm. And you were inspired by something that one of those people said to you, that you end up talking about also at the end of the book. But can you describe the sentence that
yes.
person?
Yeah, that came out of a book I wrote some time ago. It's called An Obsession with Butterflies. And I was talking to the keeper of entomology at the British Museum. I love that phrase. They call them keepers of entomology. We would call them the administrative or something. So he said, you could spend a week studying some obscure insect and you would then know more than anyone else on the planet. Our ignorance is profound. And, you know, I kept that in my head for over 10 years, just this idea that there's so much still to discover. Our ignorance is profound, and particularly, I think, in the insect world, but really in the entire natural world, there's so much we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that might be surprising to some of us to really think about that, because sometimes it feels like, well, there's so much on the internet or there's so much been written that the ignorance issue does not feel that prominent.
That is so true. I mean, so there's two parts of that for me. One part is that we do, particularly if you're connected to the natural world, there's a lot of sorrow, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of sense of loss of things going wrong on the planet. And so this is really a counter to that, that there's still so much wonderful things going on the planet. There's still so much we don't know. There's still so much mystery. There's still so much amazement. But, you know, I'm here in Portland to go to the it's a conference, the Partners in Amphibians and Reptiles Conservation. And so just the speaker yesterday was from the Xerces Society here in Portland. And she was talking about dragonfly migration and how even entomologists say, oh, dragonflies migrate. So their migration is equally as impressive as the monarchs. In fact, they fly much farther distances. And I didn't really know that. You know, so again, you know, we're just surrounded by even common insects, even ones that we feel, you know, have always been a part of our lives. Bumblebees, dragonflies, butterflies have all these mysteries about them.
And the insect that you got interested in, the tiger beetle, and a specific kinds of tiger beetles, and there are many different kinds.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how that became so important for you.
Well, that was pretty funny. David Pearson is an entomologist who's a big advocate for citizen science. So when I wanted to write about the bigger picture, I emailed him. It was just kind of a casual email, just an exploratory fishing expedition. You know, David, would you be interested in talking with me? He emailed back in about 2 hours, and he said, I want you to go over to the Rio Grande, and I want you to start studying Cincinnatus sparata, and I want you to, he's like this. Anyone who connects with him, he just sends them on the path of tiger beetles. So he sent me off on a path. I ended up studying, he's the co-author of A Field Guide to Tiger Beetles in the United States and Canada. And in that book, there are these little blank spots on the map of tiger beetles. So he doesn't know the larval biology of the Rio Grande tiger beetle. And he and his co-author didn't know the biology of the western red-bellied tiger beetle. Turns out, I went into my backyard, walked, you know, a quarter mile to the river, and there was hundreds of them swarming the riverbank. They're so small, and they skitter around on the sand, that I'd never really seen them before. I thought they were like flies, you know, sand flies. And everyone else says the same thing in my area. Really? Really? We have tiger beetles? But when you get them under, you know, a good close-focusing binoculars, they're beautiful animals. And they were right there, you know, in abundance in my backyard. No one knew where the females went to lay their eggs. No one knew what the first instars looked like. There was just, you know, these unknowns that I could take a couple years to try and discover.
And what is an instar?
Well, so the tiger beetle, like a lot of other insects, goes through different stages. So it's kind of like a caterpillar, but we use caterpillar really to refer to butterflies. So the egg hatches, and it's a tiny little grub, really, or a caterpillar-like, but very small, you know, 6 millimeters. It burrows down, and then it waits in its burrows. The tiger beetles are incredibly predacious. They're a very charismatic animal because they're real hunters. They're the fastest moving insect we have. They can gallop 5 miles an hour if you were to time them. and they have these big mouth parts, and they grab and they stab and they hold their victim and they drench their victims in digestive juices. And they're really, as I say, quite predacious and fierce. That's why they're called tigers. The larvae are equally fierce. They're, again, this little grub in its burrow. It has these little kinks on the back, and those kinks, those little points anchor it into the tunnel so it can lunge out of its tunnel, kind of like a B-movie monster grabbing an even tinier ant or spider. So then this instar goes through three stages. It eats a meal, it grows bigger, it molts its skin, and it goes through that three times before it turns into the pupa, and then the pupa metamorphosizes.
And one of the reasons you know a lot about that is that you started breeding them.
I did.
Talk a little bit about what you,
right. Yeah. What you yes. Did. All that happened in my home office. I went to collect the tiger beetles, put them in terrariums, and immediately they start mating. And so I was the first, and this is that exciting part of take a week, and you can know more than anyone else on the planet. I was the first to document these tiger beetles mating, laying eggs, and then the first instars being reared up in my terrarium. And then I would, of course, dig them up and get someone to photograph them, and then we could describe them for science. Not very important science in the sense of, you know, earth shaking, but again, that just that little bit that to add on to the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Sharman Apt Russell. We're talking about citizen science, her own work in this area, and her book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist, subtitled Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. The phone lines are open for this interview. If you have questions about citizen science and things you want to ask Sharman, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. So you mentioned that the history of citizen science goes way back to Darwin. And also, I think you have a quote in the book where you say Jane Goodall could be considered a citizen scientist.
Oh, sure, sure. Jane Goodall, you know, didn't go to college, initially at least. She went off to be a secretary for Louis Leakey. She, you know, developed a passion for studying chimpanzees. She developed a rigorous scientific method, but she didn't start off that way. And that's actually true for a lot of citizen scientists. Many of the ones I know in my little area of southwestern New Mexico go on to become true experts. You know, when you dedicate yourself, especially to a single species or to a single aspect of science, and you bring that curiosity and passion to the subject, you can get pretty good at what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So dentists become lepidopterists, and accountants, you know, become astronomers, and it's a field that has such transformative elements to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I'm particularly enthusiastic about it.
Right. There's an interesting woman in your book who is a former cheerleader who sort of combines cheerleading and
yes.
Citizen science now.
Yes, Darlene Cavalier, and I really recommend. She is the organizer of a on-site called SciStarter, and that's SciStarter. And you can go online and you can plug in what kind of program you want to be engaged in, whether it's indoors or outdoors, whether it's for children or as well. You know, if there's a cost to it, what part of the country, and it'll find this variety of programs. She's like a clearinghouse for programs. And it is, she was a professional cheerleader. I forget for what national team, but she has organized a whole cheerleading for science group. And you know, they've all done professional cheerleading. And at the same time, they're, you know, working for the Center for Biological Control, or they're also at John Hopkins, or they're also scientists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what is that site again, where people can find out about different groups?
It's a great site. It's called SciStarter. So that's SCI and then Starter, Starter. You know, really, if you went online and you just Googled your interest, urban squirrels, and then the word citizen science, something might well pop up, because there are so many citizen science programs starting all over in all areas of science, because it works so well. It works for us, for those of us who want to become more engaged in the world and engaged in a subject, and it really works well for the scientists too.
Talk a little bit about the area of global warming and how citizen science is connecting with that world?
Yeah, yeah, that's a great question. I think I am most excited about citizen science in a way, and how much it segues into environmental activism, and how you know, it leads into activism. So I'm also part of Nature's Notebook, which is a program here in Oregon. It's a national program. And you go in your backyard, or you might take a walk in a local park, whatever, some place that you can go on a regular basis once a week, and you document the life cycles of plants. So when does that plant, you know, put out new leaves? When does that plant flower? When does that plant fruit? When does that plant drop its leaves? And you do that for years. And you're doing that with thousands of other Americans who are going out in their backyard all across the country looking at plants. You can also look at certain animals. So you're helping document the changes that global warming has, or that climate change has, on our plants and animals. Mm-hmm. So, and then they put that together in a national database. And that's what happens with citizen science. You might be working in your little backyard in Portland, or my backyard in Southwest New Mexico. It goes onto an online database. Maybe it's a state database, but often it's a national one. Sometimes it's an international one. And then kind of maps are generated. This larger picture is generated of what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like you can think of informal situations where there was a fellow here that used to bring in the first daphne that he encountered every
yes.
year, and nobody mapped that out.
Right.
But it was, you know,
right.
kind of an annual activity.
Right. And now people are starting to see how worthwhile it is to map those things out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we want to know if pollinators and flowers are matching up. You know, we want to know what are the effects of climate change when insects emerge. So this is important to agriculturalists. And early citizen science was all about agriculture. So, mm-hmm. you know, in China, they've been recording, you know, outbreaks of locusts for 3,000 years. And in France, they started recording when the grapes were coming out for hundreds of years. So that kind of citizen science was very, very practical in terms of raising food.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like this year would be a good year to be involved with one of the groups that you mentioned. It's got ICE in the title, and I'm not remembering it right now.
Ice Watch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Okay. Well, you know, that's where people go out and kind of measure and look at the ice forming on a nearby pond or a lake or whatever you know, place where ice forms naturally. I think a lot of ice has melted in the last few days, perhaps. You know, it's interesting that so many of citizen science programs have the word watch in them.
Mm.
Ice watch, snow watch, mountain watch, frog watch, because that's a lot of what it is. It's having all these human eyes and human brains, this intelligence, suddenly watching the world,
mm-hmm.
and being aware of it and being kind of alert to it. So, you know, that's what we're doing. We're out there being awake in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Charmin Apt Russell. We're talking about citizen science, and we're talking about her book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist. And if you would like to ask her a question, be part of this conversation, you can give us a call at 503-231-8187. Point to any examples of important discoveries that citizen scientists have made?
Yeah, I can. And just also to broaden the topic of citizen science, I'll talk a little bit about Galaxy Zoo. So Galaxy Zoo is a totally online program. You're not going outside. It started a mere 8 years ago in 2007, and an astrophysicist had a theory about spiral-shaped galaxies versus elliptical-shaped galaxies, which ones would be better for star formation. But in order to even prove or think about his theory, he had to have huge sample sizes, lots of spiral-shaped galaxies, lots of elliptical-shaped galaxies. What he had is 1 million unclassified images from the Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico. So what really is interesting is that there are lots of things that humans do better than computers in terms of pattern recognition. So a computer can't just look at these images from telescopes, from Hubble up in space or on Earth, and say much about it. A human eye is what's required to really say, oh, yes, that's a spiral. Oh, yes, that's an elliptical. So they developed a website, he and his friends, and 2007. In the first 24 hours that they put that website up, they had 70,000 classifications per hour. I mean, people were just primed. They wanted to go online, and they wanted to learn how to classify galaxies. They wanted to be the first person to ever see this galaxy. So now, if you were to go online and classify a galaxy, it would need to be corroborated by 30 other volunteers before they said, yes, your classification is right. But that means that their results are equal to professional astronomers. So in Galaxy Zoo, you know, they have 50 million classifications a year. They have almost 1 million people working on this. So that's just classifying and helping scientists get these sample sizes. But as people go on and they look at these images that no one else has seen, you know, we have millions and millions and millions of images from all these telescopes, they sometimes see new things. So that goes back to your important discoveries. A woman named Hannah Voorhoop, she was a Dutch young woman, saw something funny on one of the slides, and she posted on the discussion group, and other people said, yeah, well, that is kind of funny. That's kind of interesting. And so it was citizen scientists who discovered these what are called green pea galaxies. They're green, or they look green to us, and they're areas of very high star energy formation. And they've discovered some other things too. So having almost 1 million people look at images from galaxies has resulted in some exciting discoveries by citizen scientists.
You're listening to Sharman Aptrussell. We're talking about citizen science. And I believe we do have a caller. Kristen, your question or comment, please.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. It's great to hear about citizen science on the radio. I know it's hard to, when you're not affiliated with anyone and you're just your own little person with your patch of yard or with your experiments to reach out and get connected with people. How is it always important to write a proposal or to get sort of signed off on a project before you begin? Or how could someone begin to do citizen science without a whole lot of connections? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's a great question. There's lots of national programs you can join. And one of the great things about citizen science for most people is joining a team. So if you wanted to look at the plants in your backyard, I would join Nature's Notebook or Project Bud Burst. If you wanted to look at certain, animals in parks, I would join other kinds of, the study of urban squirrels. So I would first see if there isn't a state or national program that is already doing something like what you want to do, and I would join them, and they would be happy to have you. But if you had something new, if you just saw something, either an insect or a plant or something that just you wanted to develop personally, I would start Googling the other experts who might know about it. And, I would just email them. What I have found is that scientists can often be extraordinarily gracious, and they're grateful to talk about their work to you. And remember, you're almost offering to be their grad assistant. So, not every scientist, not every person in the world is like this, but the majority of people are really open now to the idea of citizen science. And they're very generous when it comes to their work because they love their work. And to find someone who also is in love with that little, insect or that particular plant, you have a camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. Paul has a question. Paul, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I'm enjoying your show. So I have a question. Is there a way to access this information? For instance, I'm a beekeeper and I'm interested in the bloom cycles of certain botanical species. Now, one of those is not readily available in my immediate environment, which is the Oregon trailing blackberries, the small native blackberry here. But that's an indicator of when it's a good time for there to be enough drones to breed bees. So is there a way that a person could access this kind of information that you're talking about?
Well,
that people are collecting?
Yeah, that's great. That is really the direction that citizen science has to go, is to make that data, you know, accessible and easily found. I think right now the first thing I would do is go to SciStarter or contact the Xerces.
Okay, what is that again?
Yeah, it's a clearinghouse for all the for small and large citizen science projects around the country.
SciStarter, S-C-Y-S-C-I.
Yeah, SCI Starter. And you could also just Google bees, bumblebees, and citizen science, and see if what popped up. I would contact directly, you know, email the people who are in charge of, who are organizing citizen science programs around bees, around bumblebees, and ask them that question. And see, you know, sometimes they will have data on their websites that might interest you. It's just as likely that they might know a scientist who has that information. So you just have to jump in as a colleague and as a collaborator and as someone who says, I really share this interest. People are happy to share their data, usually. But as you know, the internet's so big, it's a matter of kind of drilling down and finding out where it is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. I'm speaking with Sharman Aft Russell. We're talking about citizen science. We're talking about her book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist, on KBOO Portland on Political Perspectives. And one program that caught my eye that it seems a little different that you wrote a little bit about is the microbomes.
Microbomes
project, collecting human skin and bacterial cells. Talk a little bit about that, and maybe we can talk about some issues regarding citizen science after that.
Right. Well, so there's a couple programs like that, and one was collecting microbes from your belly button, and so they would send out, you know, kits and swabs, and you would collect from your belly button and then send them back, and then that program closed. Another program, I think it was in the Chicago area, they were interested in when you make a move from one house to another house, how fast does that community of microbes on your body adjust? You know, so people are doing all kinds of interesting things with what, you know, the microbe communities all around us are doing. And they just kind of send out these calls to people and say, do you want to participate in this project? And there's usually parameters. You know, if you have a dog in the house, they might not want you. So that's what scientists can do now. You know, they can say, wow, I need research on this. How can I get 1,000 people to be my volunteers for this? I think I'll start a citizen science program. I'll publicize it on SciStarter. I'll publicize it through other ways I have. And by gosh, 1,000 people show up and say, I'd like to help you with this.
Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that comes up after some of these projects or in relationship to some of these projects is is it science or is it something else?
Right. Is it science or is it science education?
Right.
Is it science or is it hype? You know, yeah. Things like that. Well, of course, the answer is it is often science and science education. Almost always some science gets done. You know, sometimes a lot of science gets done. Almost always people are being educated. people are learning about galaxies. People are learning about how, you know, plants, grow. People are learning about, you know, the water and the river. And that alone is pretty wonderful. I mean, if it just operated on that level, in a world in which we have less and less time in our classrooms to learn about science, you know, if people start making policies based on science, if they just become more connected to science and to the world, that's great. So the neat thing is it does usually operate on more than one level. It can turn into activism. It can just work very well as science education. And then there's also a lot of actual data being collected and real science getting done.
What do you know about programs with kids?
Yeah, I took a number of programs into the classroom with kids. So I know what I read, but I also know from this immediate experience of being surrounded by 23 third graders going, Miss Sharman, come over here. They were so excited. I took a program called Mastin and Matrix into a third grade classroom. This was in Deming, New Mexico, a very poor school. You know, some of the kids were the children of field workers. Everyone in the school qualified for a free lunch program. And yet these little miniature paleontologists had all the enthusiasm and all the smarts required to do this very well-designed program. We were given a kilo of the fossil matrix that was around a mastodon excavated in New York. So it's a 10,000-year-old mastodon. You can imagine how much soil is around an excavated mastodon. And what did the paleontologists want to know? Well, they wanted to know what kind of little plant parts were in the soil, what kind of little clam shells, what kind of little animal parts. They wanted to know what was in that soil, and that would tell them about the environment the mastodon lived in. So they sent out kilos of soil to about 3,000 classrooms around America and had all these little kids, you know, pick them apart with toothpicks. And of course, the kids had an extraordinarily good time. And a little science was done. It turns out when you have 60,000 kids, you know, look through soil, they do a little bit better than when you have 8 professionals look through much less soil. Because they had so much more soil to look through, they found more species of seeds and plants. Mm-hmm. I think they lost a lot of samples too, or at least they did in my classroom, because, you know, jars would get overturned and things. So this was one that's operating a lot with science education, a little bit of science too. But what a wonderful thing, because those kids, many of them will always remember that day learning about the mammoth that went extinct, learning about the wild elephant that's going extinct in their lifetime. My hope is that they will grow up and be part of science and citizen science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think just the kind of observational skills that they would start to learn would be great.
Yes.
Because that's one thing that impresses me about your descriptions of the work that you have done, is just the kind of observation that is ideally required for some of these tasks.
Right. You have to learn to fill out a data form. And the programs that do citizen science have to make user-friendly data forms, and by and large, they do.
Mm. You write about being somewhat intimidated. I think it was an actual entomologist or someone who had done a description and how thorough it was and how the equipment that was needed to sort of
absolutely you know, there's a lot of terminology, a lot of jargon when you're talking about anything, but let's say when you're talking about tiger beetles, it just sounded like, you know, some archaic foreign language sometime, or like some you know the Jabberwocky poem. And then I did spend a summer dissecting the ovaries of female tiger beetles. And so I learned how to do that. But when it came time to actually describing the larval stages in the detail that science needed, I just sent that specimen off to my good friend Barry Nicely, who's the co-author of the field guide, and said, you know, Barry, you're going to do this so much better than I would do it. So, and he did. Mm-hmm. So you have your limits as a citizen scientist, and I learned why I didn't become a scientist. And when I say that, scientists laugh because they know what I mean. It is. it is very detail oriented, and it is very, it can get quite tedious. I am happy to be more of the Renaissance person who can dip in and dip into science, engage in it in a profound and satisfying way, and then go on and live another life too.
Mm-hmm. The number to call with your question or comment is 503-231-8187, speaking with Sharman Apt Russell about citizen science. And that gets what we just talked about, gets into something you did touch on before, and that is the whole issue of accuracy and sort of validating.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, about
okay.
some of the issues
involved. Because that's very important. And, you know, one thing to remember is how pretty new citizen science is in terms of this crowdsourcing. Galaxy Zoo started 7 years ago, 8 years ago in 2007, and that was really at the kind of the beginning. And so what happens when you have the education and the intelligence and the energy of millions and millions of people working on projects? We don't really know. It's just very beginning. At the beginning, these fears about inaccuracy were even stronger. And I think we've started to see how they're being solved, you know, how we're resolving this. Galaxy Zoo uses redundancy. There are so many people, you know, classifying galaxies that, again, if 30 people agree that that's a spiral-shaped galaxy, it is. And again, they can match their accuracy rate with professionals. When you send people out in the world to look at plants, to look at animals, maybe you don't have, well, 200,000 people volunteer for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They have 200,000 graduate students out there looking at birds. So that's quite a few. So they can tell there's so many observations. eBird, the online checklist, gets 1 million observations a month. When you get that many, you can see the outliers. You know, you can see where a piece of information just falls out of what makes sense and is just not corroborated by all these other volunteers. So redundancy is part of it. Some programs just check at random 10% of their data. You know, they're just going to hire someone to check and make sure that the data falls in terms of what they would expect. Good training. Of course, there's more and more training that people are giving when they set up a citizen science project. So there's more and more, there's so many ways you can get a pretty accurate, you know, citizen science project. And even if sometimes it fails, even if you have problems sometimes, it is so outweighed by the advantages. Mm. You know, the truth is you're getting so much good data that even if you're getting a little bit of, you know, false data, it's you're still just marveling at what's working, not what's not working.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you think it's affected your life as a nature writer, just generally,
Yeah.
the impact of citizen science
right.
on your writing?
Well, it's certainly those two field seasons made me, you know, slow down. So I'm kind of a person who hikes and gets from point A to point B. You know, I'm out on a hike and I'm going to get there and then I'm going to get back. So I run. I which is definitely just movement. So. Looking at things, looking for the tiger beetle, looking for the burrow holes, you know, paying attention to how the insects were behaving, made me slow down and be more present in mm-hmm. the world, in the natural world. It made me realize the value of curiosity, because that's what a lot of science comes out of. You're just curious. Why is it doing that? What's happening here? Look at that. And all these little dramas are going on in nature, you know, ants doing strange and interesting things and bees. And so it made me slow down. It made me be more curious, made me appreciate the complexity of what I was seeing more.
It sounds like it's the whole area of personal fulfillment, and it really does sort of add to someone's personal fulfillment.
It really does. And again, your interest may not be in the natural world. There's a wonderful program called Fold It, in which video gamers help biochemists synthesize new proteins by looking at the different ways amino acids combine and recombine. So there are over 500,000 video gamers helping fold it, combine and recombine amino acids. And the biochemists at this program, it's based in Seattle, are just amazed at the progress that they're making and some of the things they're trying to do. And so so these are people who are using their intelligence, doing what they like to do anyway, but now in the service of science and of these kind of larger good, solving diseases, dealing with cheap energy, some wonderful things could come out of this.
Is there a typical citizen scientist?
Well, I think what we would say now, no one knows for sure, but if you were to think about it, you would say, well, the typical citizen scientist is probably middle class, is probably educated, could even be middle-aged, probably is Anglo. That's all anecdotal. I don't think we know for sure, but it kind of makes sense. I think that could be true, but I also think it's changing. And I think citizen science programs have to do more outreach. But when I saw those kids in Deming, that's when you let the research questions come out of the community. And that's often, again, that area of environmental activism. So there are neighborhoods around America near oil refineries or near chemical plants where people are capturing the air in these plastic buckets as a simple pump mechanism. And then they're sending off that air to be analyzed by labs for, toxic compounds. So they're doing citizen science. They're analyzing the air in their neighborhood for their own reasons, because their research question is this air breathable?
Right.
Am I going to get sick? And there's more and more of that happening. And that's going to expand and extend the kind of person who's a citizen scientist. And I think that's great. I think citizen science is inherently democratic. It's about saying, no, you don't need to have a college degree in biochemistry. You can be a great video gamer. Come help us. It's about it's about this democracy of no matter who you are or what you are in life in terms of your occupation, you can join this team of people with similar interest and do real science.
Mm-hmm. And learn real science skills.
And learn real science skills, right. And bring, it's not just what citizen scientists bring to science. We're also saying, hey, science, what can you do for us? How can you help make our air more breathable and our water cleaner and et cetera? And we're also saying, I think, as citizen scientists, the other thing we bring to the table is how much we care about these things. That we're in love with salamanders. We find dragonflies spiritual. We are emotionally attached to this river. And scientists aren't always free to say these things out loud, even though I know they think and feel them. But so we bring another dimension to the whole world of science, which I think makes everyone larger.
Yeah, you can definitely sense that when you read your book and read about your work with the tiger beetle, or when you were talking about the tiger beetle earlier.
Right.
It's not something that I would... it's not like the tiger.
The tiger, yeah, I know. You fall in love with something and it makes the world more beautiful for you. And as a non-scientist, I'm free to quote poetry. I'm free to bring in my emotions and my, quote, subjectivity. And that's not incompatible with science by any means.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this interview with Sharman Apt Russell, and you can give us a call if you want to try to fit in a question here before the end of the interview about citizen science or some of the issues that we've been talking about. The number to call is 503-231-8187. You mentioned to me earlier that your work in nature writing sort of builds on past work,
right,
and how you originally wrote about the rose,
right,
and how then the butterfly book came out of that. Talk a little bit about how this book came out of your past work and where it seems to be leading you now.
Okay. Well, you know, so I had an undergraduate degree in conservation and natural resources. I wanted to write about the natural world. I mean, I was a writer first, and I wrote a book called Anatomy of a Rose, which is about flower pollination, just the secret sex life of flowers. The next book was about, was called An Obsession with Butterflies. It made sense, you know. I learned how powerful flowers are. Flowers really run the world because everything we eat depends on a flowering plant. And then with butterflies, it was kind of a book about grace. Butterflies are not extraordinarily important pollinators. They're just this kind of gift in some ways. You know, they're just so beautiful. The next, I also was writing children's literature. I have a strong interest in the subject of hunger. But the next book that related to citizen science was Standing in the Light, My Life as a Pantheist, which was about bird banding and just the kind of connections you have to the everyday world around you. And then after that, the citizen science. So I've always felt that science was really about being in love, that scientists were really just in love with the world, and that that's kind of what we are doing as humans. We're witnessing, you know, what an amazing world. We're witnessing kind of the beauty and the power of existence itself. And so it makes sense for me to be a citizen scientist. I don't want to do all the tedious work of jotting down and recording all that witnessing, but I want to write about it, mm-hmm. and I want to be involved in it.
Mm-hmm. And so how about now? What are you working on?
Well, now I wrote a book called Hunger and a Natural History, and I am building on that. It seems like quite an outlier to people when I say my next book is on childhood malnutrition. But it connects to being a citizen scientist because that's what citizen science allows people to do, to be many different things in life. Yes, you go to work and you're a dental hygienist and you're a good dental hygienist. And then, you know, on that weekend, you're studying, you know, the flowers in your backyard. You're also every once in a while taking a trip to an archaeological site. You know, you go classify a few galaxies every once in a while. You can be many things in your life. I've always had a strong interest in how hunger works in our body, and how hunger is still exists, that social justice of how can children still be hungry on this planet. So So I'll be going to Malawi in the fall to look at childhood malnutrition and kind of a solution that that might help with dealing with childhood malnutrition.
And have you also written children's literature?
Yes, and then that's the third part. I love children's literature. I have a book out this month. It's called Teresa of the New World, and it's a historical fantasy. It's set in the 16th century in the American Southwest. It's about the story of Cabeza de Vaca, who was a Spanish explorer shipwrecked in Florida in 1528. He spent 8 years among the coastal tribes of Texas, as a slave, as a trader, as a medicine man. So he's a real life figure, and I've written a novel about his daughter, who's a fictional figure. Mm-hmm. A landscape I love to live in. I'm a desert person, you know, born in the desert, raised in the desert, chosen to live in the desert, and this is very much about living in the desert.
Mm. Well, and I imagine it helps you to work in your own observations of desert life.
Absolutely. It's about ethnobotany. It's about the plants and animals and insects of the desert.
Mm. Sounds great. I wanted to ask you a couple more questions about the work in understanding climate change. And just a little bit more about how you think that people doing citizen science can affect policy, say,
right,
in that area. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, let's take Nature's Notebook. So we have thousands of Americans documenting how climate, what's happening with the plants and animals around them, and that's from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. They do maps that show, well, when are the fall colors coming out first, winter, and of course we see that things are coming out early. One thing that they have definitely seen through this program is, for example, the Tennessee warbler is migrating to areas where its food source is past. You know, there's not a synchronicity between the migrating bird and the trees and plants that it and insects that it needs. But once you've documented something, where do you go from then? Mm-hmm. Well, I think that citizen scientists, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, are going out, they're seeing invasive species, they're seeing loss of habitat, they're seeing declining numbers of things, and they're expecting their observations to have some impact. Scientists don't always, you know, they're getting tenure or they're doing something else. But these are citizens. They're, you know, and they're saying, okay, now what? And I think they're the ones that are going to be putting pressure on our administrators and our policymakers and our politicians to say, I believe this stuff is happening. What are you doing about it? Mm-hmm. I think the more people you have out there doing this and the more awareness, they have their own connections. You know, their wife is the superintendent of the National Forest, or their cousin, you know, is over here, and they're talking to each other. And it's a larger public and cultural conversation that is getting stronger and more intelligent. And that's got to be partly because of so many people getting out there and actually experiencing it. Not just reading about it in a newspaper, but experiencing what climate change means to the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's very much a recommendation for getting involved in this work.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, remember, it's fun. it's a great excuse to go out Saturday up to the, you know, to the nearby park. It's a great excuse to get outside with your kids. It's just a great excuse to be out in the world. It gives that weekend or that evening a little structure. You know, it's fun to go online and look at galaxies for, you know, 15 minutes. It's relaxing. So none of it wouldn't really be as effective if it wasn't so satisfying too. Just a fun thing to do.
And we mentioned earlier that you kind of started your work around the quote that came from the entomologist about if you spent a week on one insect. And,
right.
And you would know more than anybody else in the world. I'm paraphrasing.
Yes, but, right.
And at the end of the book, you examine that.
Right.
What do you think of that that statement after
right.
what you went through with?
Well,
the
you know, early on, I admit I say that as a statement that one says wryly, you know, not too seriously. You would know anyone more than anyone else on the planet if you were an entomologist to begin with. but just to pop into a field and study something for a week is not going to work. I took 2 years, and I know a little bit more about that particular species than some entomologists, but I know far, far less than an entomologist does about insects in general. So that was just kind of a fun entrance into it. It does speak to how much you can contribute to knowledge, you know, because there aren't enough entomologists in the world to find out everything that there is to discover. There aren't enough lepidopters, there aren't enough herpetologists, there aren't enough of these people, so they need us to go out and learn these things. I didn't actually discover all the answers I wanted to discover about the western red-bellied tiger beetle. I never really could find their burrow holes in the wild, so I'm still seeking for that. It's a puzzle to me, and it's a puzzle to the other entomologist.
Mm-hmm. As we come to the end of this interview, is there anything that you feel you'd like to emphasize, or something that you feel like we didn't touch on as thoroughly as you would wish?
No, I think we've had a good conversation. I warned you that I can talk a long time about citizen science. I wax enthusiastic.
Yeah.
I think I'll repeat something. There's a lot of problems in the world. And in the natural world, there's a lot of sadness. And this isn't a sad thing. This is a joyous thing. this is wonderful to have so many people care and come together and form new communities and get to know the world better. And that's really nice to grab onto and to hold and cherish something this satisfying and pleasant.
And I think we have a quick question from Amber as we have just a couple minutes. Amber, do you want to
I have
make
a question,
your point?
Yes, thank you. I don't do computers, but I'm really interested in this citizen scientist project, and this talk has been so wonderful. I really relate with all of this deeply, but I don't do computers. Is there any way I can be involved in anything like this without a computer?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, good.
I would go over to the Xerces Society here in Portland. Just kind of look them up, you know, in the phone book, and go
how
to their office. And just ask them. They have all kinds of programs. They're based here in Portland. They're a conservation group that does a lot of citizen science. And just say, what can I do around here? Because actually a lot of it is about being outside in the world and collecting water samples and looking at bumblebees and monitoring things.
I live in White Salmon up in the Columbia Gorge, and it's fantastic here. And I have a little garden out here, and I'm always out in my garden and interested in all the bugs and birds and everything.
Well, great. Thank you, Amber. Thank you for calling in, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you also, Sharman Aptorussel, for coming in while you're in KBOO and discussing this very interesting subject. And again, if people want to learn more about your work, your website, if they do have computers.
Right. It's www.sharmanaptorussel, SharmanAptorussell.com. Yeah.
Thank you very much. This has been Political Perspectives. Thanks to Tammy for engineering. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia coming up on KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre is with us. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein talks with student debt strikers and organizers with anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman about new revelations and earthquake dangers and the future of California's Diablo Canyon nukes. At 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone. Today, host Stephanie Potter speaks with futurist educator and author Barbara Max Hubbard about conscious evolution, awakening the power of our social potential. And we're going to get to all of that in just a moment. We have one message to listen to, and then we're going to get right to Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning into KBOO this morning, KBOO.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by West African artist Alpha Yaya.